Hello, everybody, and welcome back to We've Got Mail and a Harp. My name is William Bibbiani. I am a critic for The Wrap. Everybody calls me Bibbs.
My name is Whitney Seibold. I, too, am a critic. I write for Slash Film.
Yeah, and you're pretty cool. And this is We've Got Mail. This is where you control the conversation right here at the Critically Acclaimed Network. And if I talk fast enough, Whitney just has to take the compliment. here's how this works. You email us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. Or if you'd prefer, you can send us a physical letter at our P.O. Box. Whitney, what is our P.O. Box?
Yeah, send us an actual physical letter to P.O. Box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah, and we answer your emails and answer your letters and answer questions and respond to critiques and hear your points of view on stuff that has come up on our podcast. We love hearing from you. We love this podcast. We're sorry we weren't around last week. As you may have noticed from our social media or listening to other shows, we've been sick. We're on the mend and we're getting stronger every day. So we're back and let's do this. Let's just jump right in. Whitney, do we have any letters from the P.O. box?
We have something in the P.O. box. Our listeners have let us know, but because we've been sick and indoors, we haven't had a chance to get those letters out yet. So
no.
There's nothing right next to me at the moment, but there's something waiting. And just know that if you've sent us a letter, it's here. It's here.
Yeah.
we can't
in good conscience leave our apartments. So we will get to them next time, and we apologize for that. Yeah. Hopefully it's not too timely, but if it is, we'll apologize, and we'll read every single thing that's in our inbox, even if it's like a coupon for like a Jiffy Lube. We'll read it,
although,
we promise.
I think I've mentioned this before. One of the previous owners, whoever like was the previous tenant in our in our P.O. box, like subscribe to some really weird ultra right wing conspiracy magazine.
Oh God!
About like it's got all these like survivalist ads and articles about how, you know, like Joe Biden's son, and it's all these like terrible things. So we won't read that.
No, we're not going to read that. And I'd like to thank everybody who let us know that I think there was like a Newt Gingrich book or something that got advertised on our podcast for a few hours. Like a week ago, we called in and we had that ad removed. That is not us at all. We apologize if anyone had to hear some BS that we do not support here at our show. But let's just jump right into our emails, shall we?
Okay. This is an email that one of our dear listeners has been waiting on for a while. So, B. Peterson. She and I had a podcast together. We were doing a podcast all about the streaming service Ovid, which is one of the best streaming services. That podcast is at an end, but I'll just read the email and it'll all be explained. Anyway, the email says, "Hey friends, first things first, I'm doing well after spending 50 days in a mental health treatment facility. I'm not 100% or even 90%, but I'm stable and that's refreshing."
That's awesome. Congratulations.
Congratulations. Yeah. Thanks for being there and continuing, B, because we miss you. But B says, now onto the main event. I made a movie, or rather, Matt Reeves and company made a movie, and I futzed with it. Way back in We've Got Mail number 69, nice, y'all read a letter of mine discussing fan edits and how they very rarely gain mainstream acceptance as legitimate versions of the film, with Giorgio Moroder's Metropolis being the notable exception. I'm trying anyway, as I said I might back in We've Got Mail number 114. The Batman from this year is, in my personal estimation, not a successful film. While much of its aesthetic is admirable, its superficial trappings do not justify its long runtime, the mishandling of its female characters, both seen and unseen, are legion, and any interesting ideas it does bring up are invariably walked back. All that being said, I saw within The Batman much potential, and so I set about bringing that potential to the best of my ability. The Batman, colon, Silent Night, Night with a K, is a 97-minute recut of The Batman, making this the shortest live-action Batman film to date. It's a silent film with synced score. I think it's a lot better now, but I'm biased. People can find a link to the film in a pinned tweet of mine, and B's Twitter account is at bluegreycloset, BlueGreyCloset. Now, I'm very curious to know what you think of the film and would love for you to discuss it. However, there is a conflict of interest here, as you know, honestly, I'm sure how big a conflict it is, as I'm not getting paid for any of this, and I'm not paying you, so we'll get to that. No, B is not paying us.
No, of course not.
So here's what I'll say. This was not a job or passion project for me, rather an experiment. I'm interested to see if people think if it did or did not work. I'm not seeking unqualified endorsement here. I'm looking for analysis, something you two are very good at. With that said, here's a list of prompts. Feel free to tackle them one at a time, and let this serve as a spoiler-free warning for both versions, as I'd appreciate for you to go into detail. Yes, I watched this. I watched this cut of Batman Silent Night. It took me a little bit. But, you know, I'm locked in, so that gave me a chance to sort of catch up a little bit. And the Batman is now 97 minutes long. The original cut was like 182 or 183 minutes.
Really so long film. Yeah.
Really, really long movie. And the aesthetic it borrowed was that of David Fincher's 1995 film Seven. That was pretty much the
A lot of it, yeah.
They turned the Riddler... previously played by Frank Gorshin, into... essentially
and others.
No, just Frank Gorshin. He's the only one that matters.
Okay.
And,
Christ.
Okay, fine. Who played the Riddler in the cartoon film? In the cartoon
film? John Glover, I think.
Oh, John Glover played, okay.
I think it was John Glover, yeah.
Then John Glover, too.
and others. Okay, fine, whatever.
But the Riddler is now
the
Zodiac.
At least give some credit to John Astin, for God's sake.
All right, John Astin, too. The Riddler is now the Zodiac Killer in the Matt Reeves film.
Yeah.
The Batman went on far too long, specifically because it is one story. It doesn't have, like, it doesn't have B-plots. It doesn't stray. It's just scene after scene of Batman investigating a single crime.
Pretty much.
And uncovering a lot of corruption in Gotham City. Yeah.
If there, you could make an argument that, like, Catwoman kind of has a subplot, but it ties so directly into the main plot, it doesn't really feel like it.
Yeah. Here's a few things that B did that I really, really appreciate. There were several really big moments, and I'm going to talk spoilers on The Batman.
Yeah, it's been out for a while. It was immensely popular. It's on various streaming services. Skip ahead a bit if you don't want to hear a little bit about spoilers. Because what I'll say about this is that we're friends with B. Peterson. Full disclosure, we know them. Whitney's worked with them directly. And so we're not like giving like a proper review of this. But they did an interesting experiment, and we would like to at least raise awareness of it a little bit. So that if you want to check it out, you can. And indeed, you can do so by going to @BlueGrayCloset on Twitter.
There's a moment in The Batman where the Riddler has mailed a bomb to Wayne Manor because the Riddler wants to kill Bruce Wayne, not Batman.
Mm-hmm.
And the bomb goes off, and it looks for a moment, and we get to see this moment where Alfred, who's played by
Andy Serkis,
he opens the envelope and he sees the bomb, and it's intercut with Batman experiencing something somewhere else. And then when he kind of puts together the pieces that there's a bomb at his house, we cut to the outside and it looks like the bomb had gone... And it turns out the bomb had gone off like an hour ago.
Yeah.
So, like, he was already too late.
A little bit of trickery. And, kind of a Silence of the Lambs kind of editing gag, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. And he goes there and Alfred is fine. Like, he was able to dive out... Like, he's injured, but he was able to dive out of the way and he survived. They made it look like Alfred was dead. Stakes are raised, Alfred's alive, stakes are taken away. There's a big revelation moment where Batman confronts the John Turturro character. I think his name is Falcone or Falcone.
Mm-hmm.
And he's like Falcone
in this version, yeah.
Yeah, he's like the head gangster. He's the one in charge of all of like the criminal dealings in Gotham City. And he reveals at one point that he once did a criminal favor for Bruce Wayne's father. And Bruce Wayne's father actually knew all about the corruption and was actually kind of tied into it. And then, I think if Alfred comes in and says, no, he's not telling you the whole story. Your father was actually doing something nice. So, stakes taken away.
Exactly. No, actually, Alfred says that when Bruce Wayne goes to visit him in the hospital. And Alfred's just like, no, your dad did it because he was deeply ashamed of your mother's mental health issues. And that makes him a good man. And I'm like, I'm not sure about that. But in any case, the movie acts like, oh no, Thomas Wayne was a saint among saints, and he got caught up in something over his head, but it wasn't entirely his fault. Mm. The Silent Night cut cuts out the idea that Thomas Wayne wasn't involved.
Yeah,
it actually just allows for the possibility that maybe Bruce Wayne's family isn't a whole bunch of saints. And that's so much more daring than anything we got in the actual thing. Like, when there's so many like moments in this version where, by cutting out all of these like sort of backtracking, like this version of the Batman comes across as more bold than this movie that everyone was saying was so bold, which I can appreciate, honestly. Yeah. And again, this is not to say that the theatrical version is even worse, or it's certainly not invalidated or anything like that, but this is clearly like a heavy, dramatically different edit, and when you make those choices, it has a different impact, doesn't it?
Yeah. There's a moment at the end, and B actually cut out the entirety of this, but there was a scene where after the Riddler had been apprehended, that Batman confronts the Riddler in prison, and it's over the course of the conversation, it sounded as if the Riddler had figured out who Batman was, that Batman and Bruce Wayne were the same person.
Which would have been a big deal.
It would have been a big deal. And then they kind of walk that back, and he says something else that only made it sound like he knew who Batman was when he really didn't.
So that whole bit's gone.
Yeah, B doesn't cut the I nearly caught you bit. Like, that whole scene is cut out.
Yeah.
Like, that whole element. Not every line of dialogue has subtitles. Only a few choice ones have subtitles.
Which is how silent movies used to work. You know, people would communicate in silent movies, but they would only use title cards whenever they really needed to. So there aren't title cards in this one, though. They use subtitles, which, honestly, a part of me like kind of wishes the title cards were there. I think it would have had like kind of a classical look, but it works better, and maybe it flows a little better. It's hard to argue the point.
I suppose so. I think the intertitles would have added a lot of texture. Also, she left it in color, which I was a little upset about. It's like, no, I want to. I know it's like really red, and you know, the photography is really kind of gloomy and interesting. But I think a black and white cut of this in a silent film would have probably would have functioned a lot better.
Well, even it's also
It had looked and felt a lot like, say, a Guy Madden film, where it looked like old film stock and looked a little bit scratchy as well.
Granted, B's working the material that they had. I would say this. It's important to remember that silent films weren't necessarily all black and white. A lot of them were tinted or had color painted on. And I think tinting might have actually been a more effective take in this, where, you know, for scenes that are in the movie predominantly black and red, just absolutely drain out everything but the red. Like, for example, might have been kind of cool. There's a couple of things that that are changed in this version that are I think, really clever. I think Catwoman's motivation is much more streamlined in this version. I dig that. I think that's cool. What I'm most impressed by, honestly, is this was a 3-hour movie. If you only ever saw this Silent Night version, I honestly think you would ask yourself, how did they fit another hour in there? Because it's pretty tight. Like, the majority of like the first act,
it's almost half like the length.
The majority of like the first act is intact because it's all set up and it's mostly there. But it's I was watching this and I was like, wait, what did they cut? Hold on.
Well,
and I was kind of impressed. And I think it shows, if nothing else, as a little experiment, just how much fat there is on almost any Hollywood movie.
Oh yeah.
Just how much is like completely just like just tiny little bits of padding that you kind of don't need. Maybe they add texture, or maybe they add personality, or maybe they're just there for because you're going after a different pace. But if you just wanted to tell the most streamlined version of these stories, you could do so much more efficiently than most Hollywood movies. Not just the Batman.
Yeah, something that B cut notably was Peter Sarsgaard. Peter Sarsgaard has this entire subplot, I guess a kind of a subplot, but you know, related to the main plot, where Batman and Catwoman kind of team up, and he sends her into a club, and she has like a camera in her contact lens, and she has this conversation with Peter Sarsgaard. He's later put into a truck, and they bomb a funeral, and there's this big tense moment where he has to defuse the bomb and confess all this stuff. All of that stuff was cut. His entire character was cut.
Almost, pretty much, yeah.
He does not he does not appear on camera in this movie. And in fact, B even kind of cheekily, when his credit came up at the end, put a little subtitle that said, lol, no. like, nope, not anymore.
The bit that I don't want to reveal, because if anyone wants to check this out, and again, this is just an experiment, this is just for fun, and this is, I think, actually a work of interesting criticism.
Yeah.
When you just see, like, you know, just sort of an example, because everyone's always just like, well, what would you do differently? And one could potentially do something like this, if one had the inclination and the time and the programs necessary to do so, to say, okay, I'll take a pass at it, and I'll just give you an idea of, like, it might have worked differently. I think the ending of the Batman Silent Night, the actual ending, which is a scene that is currently in the movie, like you can see it in the thing, but then the movie moves past it so quickly that this moment, which is supposed to have, I think, a lot of resonance, kind of doesn't really. And then I think by ending it on a moment that's almost, it almost turns it into a joke. It almost turns it into like a twisted.
Well, it's a tragic ending instead of a triumphant one, and I like that better too.
Like it's not that like the Riddler like wins or anything like that, but like it basically makes the whole movie about a point that is a little more salient than Bruce Wayne needs to have better PR as Batman, which unfortunately is kind of what the movie ultimately comes down to at the end. It's like, oh, I was scaring people too much, and maybe it'd be better if I was a little more inspirational. And I'm like, you spent 3 hours on that? Whereas I feel that the ending that The Silent Night has is such a good idea to end it like right there. You don't need any more. Like, it actually works really, really nice. So I'm going to say this about The Batman Silent Night. We're not reviewing it. We're just talking about some interesting choices that were made. If you want to check it out for yourself, you can. I think it's an interesting take on the material. I think it is an act of criticism. And I can respect it on that level, even if it was only that level. But I think interesting choices are made, and it's kind of fun to see what people do with art once it is out of the creator's hands. Much as, you know, and you can see this in everything, like little micro ways, like if you go on, like, I don't know, Redbubble or TeePublic, and you see that people will take pre-existing characters or movies and they'll like sort of morph them into their own personal style or combine them with other works, and things just become a little transformative, and this is a more direct version of that. But I think that's interesting and exciting when done well. I know people who have done like fan edits that turned the Obi-Wan Kenobi 6-episode series into like one epic movie, which I'll bet works. I haven't watched that cut, but I bet that works fine. Like, that makes sense to me. I think this is interesting work, and please check it out if you have any interest, I guess. It's just as an experiment, it's just as a project,
I've seen fan edits like this in the past. At Cinephile Video, just somebody came by and dropped off a DVD of an edit of all things, The Phantom Menace, the Star Wars movie.
Oh, is this the one that cut out Jar Jar?
It didn't cut out Jar Jar. It actually cut out it's another thing that shortened it to about 90 minutes, so it actually cut off a lot of the fat. There's a lot less sort of talky bits that are, you know, story oriented, but really kind of slow down the pace. And they also like redubbed all of the alien characters into like their own alien languages. So it feels like a little bit more science fiction-y. And
well, also in some cases, those aliens are speaking in not very respectful, like
The Nemoidians.
That's not a great accent. A lot of people said that was offensive. So one could make the argument that that's, you know, again, an act of criticism. That wasn't cool. You didn't have to do that. You know,
another person I know did. fan edit of Inland Empire, the David Lynch movie, which is also a film that's like 3 hours in length, and also cut that one down to about 90, 95 minutes. And I remember he said at... and he screened it. He had it at like at a theater with it was just like friends. He didn't open it to the public. He wasn't trying to make money off of David Lynch.
And nor should anyone do that with a fan edit. Obviously, these are just projects for fun. That's the reason why I keep saying that. I want to make sure that's clear. We don't support just, you know, that kind of exploitation. It's an interesting project to do. That's all.
But yeah, he said that this was an attempt not to make a great film because, you know, Inland Empire already exists, but it is trying to make it into a more kind of accessible movie, and I feel like he kind of did it. Okay. I think one of the big points of something like Inland Empire is that it does sprawl, that there's like little asides, there's short films that are sort of dropped in the middle that don't relate to other things, and that's kind of just the way it was structured. It was the way David Lynch kind of dreamed it out. But the way he constructed it actually does feel like a feature film. It's a little bit more, like he said, a little bit more accessible.
Yeah, I feel like fan edits is something that maybe, you know, obviously only some people actually take the time to actually do it, but I feel like on some level everyone does it a little bit, even if it's just in your memory. When you remember a movie, and maybe it's been a long time since you've seen it, and you kind of like mentally delete the bits that weren't interesting to you, and the parts that did coalesce in your head are the parts that feel like that's the movie to you. And maybe they're a little skewed. Maybe they're not entirely accurate. Or maybe your a particular lens through which you view the film sort of tints the entire experience and makes it a little different, so that when you actually watch the movie again someday, you're like, oh, wait, that's not the movie I remember. It's a little different.
Yeah.
And I feel like a fan edit is just sort of making that version of the film that you can see in your head, or maybe the version that you're like, oh, it's so close. If they just changed one or two things. Like, you can show other people what you envision, which is interesting. Again, there's a danger of exploitation. You don't want to have people, like, going around making money off of these things. But, like, it's an interesting experiment. And, again, I can definitely appreciate it as a work of criticism. We should move on.
Okay.
So let's do that, because we talked about this for a bit.
All right. Here is a letter from Anna. Hello, Anna.
Hi, Anna.
This is just a quick check-in. It says, just saying hi. Dear Bibbs and Whitney, I've been listening to you for 6-7 years and support you on Patreon for, I guess, about 5. Wow, thank you. I appreciate that. But since February 24th, when my country of birth started a war, I can only listen to Russian/Ukrainian podcasts about the war. I so much hope the war will end soon, and I will be able to enjoy you guys digressing and suffering through bad movies and TV shows and being best friends and Luca not getting off the table and all of that again. But for now, I wanted to tell you I miss you, and I hope you're doing fine, as well as your partners, kids, cats. Oh, and bitch about the fact that Paramount/CBS decided they don't want any money from European Trekkies. We still don't have a proper legal access to season 4 of Star Trek Discovery, not to mention Strange New Worlds. Sincerely yours, Anna. Golly.
That sucks.
First of all, war sucks. War is the ultimate failing of civilization. It's the opposite of creation. And so that is happening, and that is having so many huge ripples across the world sucks for everyone, and that it's sort of led to so much horribles. For that, we go out. Our heart goes out to you. But of course, most horrendous of all is Star Trek is not available globally.
That's not even funny, but it's true. That is annoying, and that's thanks. And I'm sorry. And hopefully you can hear this now. I don't know, but like, thank you for reaching out to us and to anyone in similar situations. If you get to this podcast, we've missed you, and we again, I wish we could. If I could hand deliver the podcasts, I would.
Yeah.
So that I'm sorry about that. But thank you for checking in. And I think it's important to remember, because we get the news cycles work so fast nowadays, and it's so easy to get wrapped up in the newest dangers and scandals and climate change fiascos and political turmoil that we forget that many of these stories that are hugely impactful, they don't go away just because we moved on to another headline for a while.
Yeah.
And a lot of really bad things are still happening all over the world, and there's still a crisis in the Ukraine, and we shouldn't forget that, and we definitely shouldn't go too long without saying, you know, again, our support for everyone in the Ukraine right now and everyone who has been wrapped up in this terrible situation. So we don't want to speak out of school. It's not our field of expertise or anything, but thank you for reaching out, and I'm glad that we've been able to provide some entertainment when we could, and hopefully these things will be resolved hopefully very soon.
Let's go to another letter. From Ray. Hello, Ray.
Hi, Ray.
It says, and we're a little behind on our letters, so these are all throughout, pretty much all throughout the month of July. So we're bouncing around a bit to try to get to a backlog here. Hi, Bibbs and Whitney. On the last We've Got Mail, there was a discussion about the kinds of movies people like to watch or music they listen to when they're feeling down or depressed. I'm definitely the kind of person that prefers to lean into comfort in an attempt to feel better rather than leaning into things that fit the bleak and depressed mood I'm already in. I've noticed, however, that I have a very particular type of movie that I find comforting, and that is the, quote, everything is horrible, but it turns out at least kind of okay in the end movie. These may include varying degrees of comedy or action. There's probably a feeling of catharsis involved in the struggle overcome, as well as hope and uplifting feelings when things turn out okay in the end, and that's why I find what I find comforting about them. Examples from my own personal movie list include, but are not limited to, Deep Impact, The Martian, Die Hard, 28 Days Later, and Signs. Note that I'm not lauding any of these movies as the pinnacle of cinema. Your opinions on their quality may vary, but they are movies that I enjoy. I find it very amusing that what different people find comfort in. Off the top of your heads, would you recommend any other random everything is hard and or horrible but turns out okay in the end movies? And Bibbs, since you're also in the comfort movie rather than in the bleak cinema category, what types of genres of movies or other media are your go-to? Do your go-tos tend to fall into? Much love to you both, and Luca, and yay for the new kitty, Dante. Signed, Ray.
Ray, thank you so much. You're describing a genre that I'm actually very, very fond of. To my best of my knowledge, it's never been properly codified. My dad called it the poor bastard genre, which is basically the protagonist or protagonists of the story. Everything goes wrong to the extent that it's not just a bad day. It's like the filmmaker has it out for them. Like the filmmaker is like determined to ruin their lives. And the heroism, the catharsis comes from persevering, still trying, and getting to the end of the film. I love a lot of movies in this. They don't always end happily. Sometimes it's just a matter of surviving. Which you might see in a film like Evil Dead 2 or Martin Scorsese's After Hours. Sam Raimi has made a bit of a cottage industry of this. I think Spider-Man 2 in particular is one of these movies where it's basically, how absolutely impossible can I make it for Spider-Man in that movie? So that at the end of the movie, when he decides he's just going to be Spider-Man, embrace who he is, and save the day, it is like, oh, thank God. Oh, what a relief. It's so well done. I'm also really, really fond of a movie, and it's a bit of a more of a dark comedy, because like the main characters are criminals, but they're likable criminals. There's a really, really wonderful movie called Quick Change, starring and directed by Bill Murray. I think he co-directed it. At the beginning of the movie, Bill Murray, Gina Davis, and Randy Quaid pull off the perfect bank heist.
They show you the whole heist. It's a big part of the movie.
Oh, yeah. It's the whole first act of the movie. It's just this absolutely impeccable precision heist. Everything goes perfectly. The only thing that goes wrong is the getaway. And the getaway takes the majority of the movie because every single thing that could possibly go wrong with the getaway goes absolutely horribly wrong. And they're just desperately trying to get out of New York City before the cops find them. And just watching Bill Murray gradually like lose his shit.
Yeah.
As like, because there's a bit, like, for example, there's a bit in it where like all they got to do to get to the airport and get on a plane is get on a bus. Here's a bus. It's the only bus that's going to get us there in time. but the bus driver insists on exact change. They do not have exact change. The bus driver says
they have millions of dollars, but they don't have exact change.
Yeah, they literally have millions of dollars strapped to their body, but they don't have exact change. So Bill Murray says, how long can you wait? And the guy says, I'm only allowed to wait here for 90 seconds or something to that effect. So Bill Murray like runs off the bus, goes into a liquor store. There's one person in front of him at the liquor store, and it's like an old lady who is paying with pennies. And it's just like, oh, come on! Come on! Like, it's absolutely glorious in every respect.
I really love quick change. For movies, the thing about, like, a lot of those, what did your dad call them? The poor bastard movies?
He called them poor bastard movies. I'm not a huge fan of that term, but that was what he called them, yeah.
There are a lot of movies like that I can't watch just because they're far too stressful. Case in point, you know, a lot of people like The Out of Towners, the original Out of Towners, with Jack Lemmon.
I hear you.
That's a movie about a fellow who's trying to take a trip to New York, and New York just tries to murder him. He, like, they can't land for a long time. It's just about frustration after frustration. And
excuse me.
They just get, the central couple in the movie just get more and more frustrated with every turn. You know, their money gets stolen. Just, there's garbage everywhere. They can't concentrate on what they're doing. Their luggage is taken. Their hotel doesn't go through. And I don't find that funny. And I don't, and there's not a triumph big enough to warrant all of that suffering.
It is a difficult balance. It is a difficult, because you got to make sure that it's also tricky because sometimes the protagonist can be so unlikable you don't care that bad things are happening to them. This happened with that Jonah Hill comedy, The Sitter. It's basically a remake of another movie, which Adventures is basically about the same thing. Yeah, it's basically a remake of Adventures in Babysitting, although I don't know if it's official or not. Adventures in Babysitting is actually a good-natured film, which is very, very much, she's babysitting some kids, her friend is stranded in the big city, she has to go pick up her friend, and then everything that could possibly go wrong does. But they're good-natured, so you want to you want that to persevere. Jonah Hill is such an asshole in The Sitter, you don't want him to persevere. So the balance can easily be thrown off. I also find like some of them are just mean-spirited, like it doesn't feel like they're in good fun, it feels like I'm supposed to be enjoying the pain, not the perseverance. Like, I feel like Meet the Parents is like that, where I just find especially the original, I've never actually seen the sequels, but like the original Meet the Parents is just like, I feel like I'm supposed to enjoy this guy keeping trying to win Robert De Niro over, but instead the movie seems to think I'm supposed to enjoy him suffering, and I don't think that's the same thing.
Yeah. Which, you know, there's a good way to make that kind of a movie as well.
Sure.
Just sort of the idea of somebody constantly getting their comeuppance and never really putting things together that they need to behave differently.
Because then it's like a Bugs Bunny cartoon. Here's someone who actually like deserves this punishment.
Yeah.
Because then that's a very different kind of catharsis. Mm. You know, it's actually just funny. One of my favorite comedies is this exact genre, but in reverse, and it shouldn't work. Like, there's no conceivable reason why this concept should work, but it does. And it's a Richard Dreyfuss comedy called Let It Ride. Let It Ride stars Richard Dreyfuss as a lifelong gambler, and his girlfriend, who is it Terry Garr or Glenn Headley? His girlfriend is basically, like, at the end of her rope, she's like, you can never gamble again or we're through. And on that day, his friend, who's a cab driver, happens to be, like, driving a guy who's rigging a horse race. So he knows who's gonna win. It's a sure thing. So he decides to do it, and that sets him on the most unusual path, the one day in his life where he cannot lose. Every single thing he does goes right. And believe it or not, they managed to get a lot of suspense and drama and comedy out of it. Like, that shouldn't be interesting. It is absolutely exciting and wonderful. I love it to pieces.
If you want a comedy film about everything going wrong, there is Peter Bogdanovich made a really wonderful film about, like, the world's worst play production. It's called Noises Off.
I love this movie. This movie's great.
Noises Off is based on a play. It was meant to be seen on a stage, but Peter Bogdanovich really keyed into making that work and timing it out on film to a sublime slapstick comedy that is really on the level of something like Clue. I feel like people don't talk about Noises Off quite enough. But yeah, it's about Michael Caine is the director of this troupe. The troupe includes Carol Burnett and Julie Haggerty is the head of stage crew. Denholm Elliott. Christopher Reeve is in it. John Ritter is in it. And it's like the last rehearsal before they're putting it on, and they still don't have it. They still don't know how to time this out. They have all these really kind of weird questions, and it's this weird conflict of personalities and all of the internal dramas that are manifesting themselves on stage. And we get to see the play gone through multiple times and just gets worse each time. And the worse it gets, the funnier it is. That's something that I really love, because I've been in high school. I was part of a lot of theater projects. So I can relate to sort of that kind of stress, and that
it feels pretty real, even though it's absurd. Like if you've been in like, I forget what the exact expression is, but basically the old adage was whenever I did theater in high school or college was, if you have a terrible dress rehearsal, it's going to be a great play. So I've had nothing but terrible dress rehearsals. They're always a mess. And so it feels really genuine, even though it's wonderfully, the dialogue is sparkling and the comic timing is brilliant. Am I the only person, I might be the only person who really likes the Sylvester Stallone comedy Oscar?
Yeah, you're the only one.
Okay, well, I stand by it. I actually like Oscar a lot. Oscar stars Sylvester Stallone as a gangster in, like, the Prohibition era named Snaps Provolone. And Snaps is trying to go legit. And this is all about the day when he's trying to go legit, trying not to do anything illegal, trying to do everything right. And then it turns out that his daughter, played by Marissa Tomei, has gotten pregnant by their chauffeur, a guy named Oscar. And that sends his entire day to hell as he tries to find this Oscar guy, tries to get her married to any guy she possibly can. People who are coming in to, like, do, like, actual legitimate business keep running into his various, like, ex-hitmen who are trying to stay on the straight and narrow, but there's a whole lot of misunderstandings. Meanwhile, the feds are, like, watching from across the street and misinterpreting everything. I actually think it's got a really fun, snappy energy to it, so I like that one quite a bit, even though most people don't. to answer the other question, though, real fast, like, what movies do I watch to unwind or when I'm dealing with a lot of stress and I just want to relax? Dance movies are a great example of this. Step Up and the various films of its ilk. There's a narrative simplicity to them that I really admire, and it's easy to fall into musical numbers, basically. Music movies in general are also really, really great. A good concert movie like Stop Making Sense or The Last Waltz is another example of something I would put on when I'm really stressed or depressed. So yeah, hopefully that helps. I don't know. All right, we should move on.
Here's a question for you, William. This one comes from Jeremy. Okay. It says, hey guys, so on critically reclaimed episodes on Tammy and the T-Rex, or was it Tanny and the Teenage T-Rex, Bibbs mentioned his desire to meet Ronald McDonald when he was 6, so he could ask him questions about the Fry Guys and Grimace. I really want to know what those questions are, Bibbs. I think your fans deserve no need to know what the brain of 6-year-old William deemed so important that it was worth suffering a shitty hamburger for the chance to meet a rather murder house looking clown. Sincerely, Jeremy. William, okay. What did you need to know about the Fry Guys and about Grimace?
A little bit of context here in case you missed the episode we did on Tammy and the T-Rex. Mm-hmm. The director of Tammy and the T-Rex directed a film called Mac and Me, which was sponsored by McDonald's, like heavy McDonald's marketing in it. And there's a scene in that movie where they just happen to go to a McDonald's and there happens to be like a birthday party attended by Ronald McDonald. And the implication in the movie is that this isn't weird. Like, this is just a normal thing that happens at McDonald's. So when I was a kid, I thought if I went to McDonald's often enough, eventually I'd just run into Ronald McDonald. That never happened. They never had, like, themed, costumed people at the McDonald's. You'd think they would have during that heyday of Ronald McDonald and Mayor McCheese and the Fry Guys and stuff, but they didn't. And I mentioned that I would have liked to have asked Ronald McDonald questions. Now, if this is an excellent question, and I have to think back a little bit. I definitely would have asked, and this is just a kid question for clowns, if Ronald McDonald's feet are actually that big or if they, like, padded the shoes. That's just a general curiosity thing. I would also like to ask if different colored Fry Guys taste different. Like, Fry Guys were, like, these little, like, almost like these koosh balls, but they were made of giant French fries, and they had googly eyes and feet, and they would walk around, but they're made of food, right? So, like, I assumed you could just, like, pluck a fry off of it and eat it. So, like, does the blue Fry Guy taste different from the green Fry Guy?
I think, William, I think...
Why don't we have those available at McDonald's, those different flavors?
I think they just looked like fries. I think if you were to pluck one of those strands off of a Fry Guy, they would bleed out of the strand.
Well, like, that would be good to know, wouldn't it? Yeah. That way I don't commit, like, a horrible faux pas on the day that, like, let's say I go to McDonald's and a Fry Guy is there.
Okay.
Wouldn't that be embarrassing?
I suppose so. I suppose if I go to a McDonald's, first of all, why am I there? But if I go there and this anthropomorphic eyeball creature walks up and it's clearly made of food, yeah, my first instinct is to eat it. I don't think that way when I see a cow and that thing's made of food.
Exactly. Exactly. But now, so these things are made of, like, prepared food. Like, does Mayor McCheese always have the same burger, or does he get that replaced when it starts to smell?
No, his bodily humors refresh the meat.
Bodily humors?
You heard me.
Wow. I heard you. Wish I hadn't, but I heard you.
Here's my theory. A grimace, the big purple thing, Grimace is an invertebrate. And Grimace is like if you were to slice Grimace open, there would be no bones. It would just be like soft white chicken meat all the way through. Like, I think he's a giant nugget.
That was my theory always, was that he was a nugget or a pickle. And that's another thing I would, of course, ask is, what is the Grimace, really? And I suspect Ronald McDonald, being a cool guy, we all saw that, like, commercial where, like, that one kid couldn't go ice skating and he took him ice skating because he's a cool guy. Like, Ronald McDonald's a pretty chill dude.
Yes.
I suspect Ronald McDonald would say that's a deeply personal question and you shouldn't ask that of the Grimace. That's the Grimace's choice.
Okay.
To let the world know. But I also suspect that he is some sort of invertebrate, and if you did cut him open, there would be some kind of silica inside,
little balls would spill out.
Yeah, like a little sort of like a fiberglass endoskeleton, basically. Like, it just, like, he definitely has a form.
Okay.
But it's clearly, like, gelatinous to an extent. It's
sort of like that thing underneath Scarlett Johansson's skin and under the skin. Mm.
I would also like to know, Mayor McCheese, who's a cheeseburger, who is the mayor. Got it. Who did he run against?
Gavin Newsom.
He had to be elected. Was it Birdie? Was it Ronald? Who? And if so, what were their different platforms?
He ran against the Perilous Purple Pie Man of Porcupine Peak, and the Perilous Purple Pie Man was a little too pie-centric for denizens of McDonald's land.
Okay, another question. Have you ever tried just, like, giving the Hamburglar hamburgers? And then, well, he wouldn't be an outcast.
He wouldn't, like, be a burglar then. He would just... If you take away his ability to burgle, he's a social outcast. Yeah, but you take away his identity. Social outcast is where he's comfortable. Have you considered that he likes being a social outcast?
Okay, well, then that's you know what? That's an excellent point. My other question is, if you took off the Hamburglar's mask...
Yes.
Wouldn't he look like Alfred Newman from Mad Magazine? Because I think he would. And are they indeed the same guy?
No. Alfred E. Newman would be upfront about that sort of thing. They do have similarly cherubic faces, though. I see why you would make
I just feel like it's possible. Anyway, these are some of the questions I might have asked Ronald McDonald. Thank you for asking.
Okay.
I jest, but seriously, most of those are stuff I probably would have asked Ronald McDonald when I was a kid.
Also,
At least the Fry Guys and Grimace. Yeah. I would have at least asked those two.
Having said all that, I think you should read Eric Schlosser's book, Fast Food Nation, which talks about just the horrendous practices that McDonald's goes through to get their food to you and their kind of weird, spotty history. It's a really fascinating book.
I'm aware of it, but yeah, if anyone at home hasn't, indeed. Yeah. All right, let's move on.
All right, here's a letter from Jinxie, and this addresses something that that we complain about kind of recently. It says, Dear Whitney and Bibbs, the subject of not liking Captain America the Winter Soldier because of the Nazi, Hydra infiltration has come up a few times on your podcast. This is actually one of the few things that I think Marvel got right because it's based on actual history.
Well, okay. That's an interesting point. That's a fair point, and I'll let them illuminate this, because this is true, actually.
Yeah, once World War II was over, the United States government welcomed with open arms over 600 Nazi scientists and engineers. It was called Operation Paperclip. I actually knew about Operation Paperclip. Mm-hmm. The movie shows it mirrors through news clips and documents where you see good, upstanding people like Peggy Carter working side-to-side with the Hydra scientist Zola. In reality, perhaps one of the best-known Nazi scientists to join America was Wernher von Braun. I know about Wernher von Braun. He helped get men on the moon with his rocket designs. He was also one of the Nazi scientists who came up with the V-2 rockets used to bomb England and used work camps to build them. An administrator discovered his history, and it was mostly just shrugged off. The reason I think this is meant to parallel history is because it suggested that it's the same kind of program. Peggy knew what sort of man Zola was, and she continued working with S.H.I.E.L.D., which means the MCU America isn't innocent. It welcomed Hydra with open arms for technological supremacy over its enemies. Of course, I don't think they do a great job of exploring this, except for a few nods, such as Nick Fury being willing to let that gunship that would just kill people on a certain list be built and supported using it. It's only when not the right people have it that he suddenly has an issue. That's mostly just quick lines, though. Maybe I just wanted to talk about Operation Paperclip, because it's something that doesn't get covered a lot. My first introduction was mostly due to my studying space history for my thesis. Just wanted to give my two cents, Jinxie. That's actually all. I knew about Wernher von Braun. I actually learned about Wernher von Braun through a Tom Lehrer song when I was 12. Because in the 1960s, he was helping to build rockets in America, but he had a pretty sketchy history about working with the Nazi Party.
That's putting it really mildly. Yeah, that's putting it real mildly.
So, my issue with the Winter Soldier, though, isn't so much that they kind of hand wave this welcoming of Nazis into the government. It's that those Nazis weren't just working with S.H.I.E.L.D. That's not the issue in The Winter Soldier, that Nazis and the government were working together. It's that the Nazis were secretly proliferating throughout and trying to undermine the government. And the big conspiracy was, it turns out that there's all of these secret super Nazis hiding out in the government who have been manipulating the government for decades, making sure that the government do evil things just because they're into evil. And the extension from that was, it seemed to be looking at a lot of grievous crimes that the U.S. government did historically commit of their own volition, and put the blame on this fictional Nazi group. And I feel like that's a little bit irresponsible. Like, it's trying to say that the U.S. government was somehow peerless, and all of the wicked things it did were perpetuated by this secret Nazi cabal.
Yeah, I agree with you on that point. And I think it boils down to two fundamental things. And again, I actually like Winter Soldier. I think it's a good movie. But I do think that in bringing the subject up, they had a responsibility to tackle it as best they could. And I don't think they did. I think there's two elements to it. One, as you elucidated, and again, Operation Paperclip, very real thing. Look it up. Pretty shameful chapter in our history. First off, the American government has done many, many horrible things over the course of its history, including to this day. And by basically saying, no, it was Hydra doing all the bad stuff, you're basically saying that the American government is fundamentally good. It was only these bad actors working from within, even though people with terrible agendas, many times racist, homophobic, sexist, xenophobic, and all other kinds of horrible things besides, we didn't need other people to do that. Americans were doing that all by themselves. So that right there is kind of letting America off the hook, at least tacitly, and so that's not really doing it great. But the other thing is that even when you allow that, again, Operation Paperclip, very, very real, Nazis, former Nazis, or just plain Nazis, were allowed into American programs, ostensibly because we thought we could exploit them. When you make it Hydra instead of the Nazis, you change it. At least a little. And I think in a significant way. Because Hydra, although it was a Nazi splinter cell in Captain America the First Avengers, we never actually got a clear idea of their ethos other than fascism and supremacy. We know what the Nazis did to vast swaths of people in a truly horrifying and terrible way, whereas Hydra, a little less specific in some regards, and as a result, they come across as the more PG-13 friendly version of the Nazis. And so you're not even really dealing with the Nazi thing as clearly as you could, I think. Yeah, and I think that's at least to the film's detriment a little,
When the Hydra and Red Skull and Captain America first were, like, making it big in comics in the 1940s, I can understand why they would want... because you can only kill Hitler once, right? In the comics?
Right.
You do that and it's done. But when it comes to these secret supervillains, you can write more stories. So I understand why comic book writers might need to invent this secret cabal just for storytelling purposes. It let a lot of Nazi war crimes happen in the comics without having to concern themselves with what was going on in the real world. And
one could argue at the time that, like, having Captain America, the famous issue of Captain America where, like, punches Hitler, but like having Captain America actually end World War II, for example, would be a little disrespectful to what's actually going on in World War II. You want to try to find stuff for him to do that aids the war effort without undermining or disrespecting the contributions of real-life soldiers. Which I get, and I think that's important. I think it's valid.
I feel it was a really, really odd choice to continue with that tack in Captain America the First Avengers. Because... Was it Avenger singular or Avengers plural?
I just had a little bit of word soup. No, it's I accidentally said Avengers. It's the Captain America the First Avenger. I was debating whether or not to stop and correct myself, and I was like, it's okay. And then it turned into a whole thing. It's Captain America the First Avenger.
First Avenger. I'm kind of surprised they just didn't go with, you know, just straight up revisionist history. It's like, okay, here's Captain America. He took care of this one, like, sort of secret Nazi cabal, but it actually had, like, an adverse a very positive effect on the war. He actually changed the course of World War II, sort of like this weird historical revisionist thing. That would have been
an
interesting tack. Well, but they did the whole Hydra thing instead. And
well, I realize that, but Hydra is very specifically shown to be a Nazi offshoot, so that while everyone else was dealing with the regular evil Nazis, Captain America was dealing with the super Nazis that other soldiers couldn't handle on their own. So he helped and did all this incredible stuff, but all the people who actually did the work to end World War II, they still did that. Captain America didn't take any of that away from them, which I think would have been in poor taste.
Might have been in poor taste. There could have been a scene where, like, this fictional character, Captain America, this kind of bold, almost innocent, pure face of U.S. patriotism, could have looked at, like, you know, don't actually dramatize it because it was too horrible to film in a PG-13 action film, but actually, like, learn about and discuss and be completely horrified by what the Nazis were actually doing during World War II.
That would have been... it would have been, like, great to address it, like, honestly.
Bold-face, soldierly patriotism kind of falls apart in the face of actual Nazi war atrocities. And I think it could have gone a lot further. But, you know, I'm always looking for things to go further. People wanted, superhero adventure.
Captain America the First Avenger was trying to capture that kind of Raiders of the Lost Ark tone. And I think they succeeded to a degree. But again, the more you try to tackle something that is real and relevant to this day and super important and had a lot of horrible impacts on a lot of people, the more responsibility you take on to do it respectfully, correctly. And again, if you even slightly whiff it, again, you might be able to say, oh, they did pretty good. Mm. Okay, but I also think that it is perfectly rational to say, but they could have done it better, and I think that's a fair point to make and discuss. I happen to like both the First Avenger and the Winter Soldier, but I think they are absolutely worthy of criticism in how they handle some real-world events and sanitize them a bit. And while Winter Soldier seemed pretty bold for when it came out based on what was going on in the blockbuster landscape, in retrospect, it seems like it didn't go nearly far enough.
Yeah, yeah.
And so, and again, hindsight's 2020, well, but I could definitely say at the time that there were decisions they could have made on the day that would have been a little bolder and would have definitely, like, not let America off the hook so easily.
Yeah. But, you know, you look over, I remember being really disappointed when the first, like, Avengers team-up movie came out. Because it came out, and it was superheroes fighting each other, it was a supervillain with a magic gem, it was aliens invading, and they fought the aliens. They fixed a big plane, and they fought each other, and then they gathered together, and they fought aliens. And and my attitude was one of... Really, that's all? That's all you people want to see is just superheroes doing superhero stuff? And the answer is yeah, that's what people wanted. They wanted to see just superheroes doing superhero stuff. I thought,
well, no one,
if they were going to go to the bother of doing something that was pretty unprecedented at the time, you know, introduce the characters and then have a team-up movie, which, you know, was considered earth-shattering in 2012, that they would do something kind of interesting storytelling-wise. They didn't really. They just sort of introduced the characters in previous movies and then had them do fight stuff. It's like, I see that stuff in the comics. What can you do different with a movie? Oh, nothing. You're not doing anything different than the movie.
I feel like the first...
dramatizing it in live action and with CGI animation. That's the only
difference.
You've
got a good point.
The story's the same.
You've got a good point, but I would argue, and to some extent, yeah, okay, fine. The movie nowadays feels pretty simplistic, but... I think Marvel had... this was their goal. Just to show that it can be done because it hadn't before. Mm. So they're going to keep it real simple. We introduce all these characters that we like. We want to see him hang out. Mm. We want to see him fight. And we want to see him fight together. And as long as we do those three things and we keep it clean and we keep it simple...
Yeah.
They're not going to fuck it up. So I think they tried to keep it simple just to prove that the concept could be effective. And then they got a little more ambitious later, and I think Age of Ultron did not work. It feels like there's a lot of... In addition to just problems with the writing, it feels like it's kind of not telling like an interesting enough story in and of itself. But then, you know, Infinity War and Endgame were ambitious.
I mean, it was the same thing.
They were
thing.
More ambitious. They
the
tried
same
the
thing.
Stuff.
It was just more characters doing different things. It was the same kind of story. They're just getting together to fight.
Well, I'm not sure. Do you want Armistead Maupin's Tales from the City, but with superheroes?
I mean,
what are you hoping for that you're not getting here? Because I'm curious, like what you need that you're not getting. What do you need?
Here's the weirdo in me. It's like I don't want to see any fighting in these movies. I don't want there to be a big action climax. I don't want to see them fighting off a supervillain. I want them to be hoodwinked by a supervillain, perhaps. It's like you get all these heroes together and they're still not effective. Maybe make some sort of point about the reason you're getting these people together, other than just have an action sequence. You can just have an action sequence. And that's always the most. That's always, you know, the most boring part of the movie is the action sequence.
I actually agree with you here. I mean, I like a good action sequence, but it needs to be justified and it needs to be done well.
So they just spent multiple movies setting up an action sequence. Like, well, you didn't need multiple movies for that. All you're doing is having the characters do violence.
For me, the final action sequence is
maybe,
just
do something clever.
I think they do some fun things. Listen, I think the final action sequence is just. Nothing but in-your-face fan service. And that's not a terrible problem, but it's not particularly interesting. I think that the whole we're going to time travel and go back to previous installments and talk about how all of our main characters have evolved as people since then, that's an interesting choice. I don't think it's necessarily a great film, but I appreciate that Infinity War is incredibly unstructured and has this weirdly freewheeling Robert Altman quality where we're just going to sort of bounce around from character to character, and eventually this Thanos thing is going to bring it all home. Like, I actually, like, I think that they're trying to do something interesting structurally, but I'm with you that there's definitely more work needs to be done to make it What's what I'm looking for here? You know what I think it boils down to in some regards is that these movies feel the need to be big, giant spectacles.
Uh-huh.
And ironically, seeing more and more Marvel-like stories go to television and be handled reasonably well, like, to varying degrees. I don't think Moon Knight was great, but, mm-hmm. like, you see them, like, when you have more time to breathe with stuff like WandaVision or Loki, and you realize that, like, yeah, here's where we get all that room for character interaction and development and to explore mm-hmm. ideas and themes together rather than just jump from one cool thing to the next. There's a reason why these stories found their initial popularity in serialization.
Yeah.
Because
yeah,
you can live with them
yeah, and,
for
and
extended periods. And so I honestly feel like the more we go on here, the more that like TV feels like a better fit for a lot of Marvel stuff, especially since Disney is willing to throw money at it.
Yeah.
And actually make it like, you know, it doesn't look cheap. Mm. It's cheaper than the movies, perhaps, but like it doesn't look cheap. Like you can actually like still make all the stuff that you would want in a superhero movie look pretty cool, yeah, which is part of it too.
Anyway, I don't want to talk about Avengers anymore.
Let's do one more letter. I've probably just
alienated everybody by saying action movies, boo.
You know what, Whitney, your perspective on the action genre in general, on superhero movies in particular, I think is well documented, and I think what you have shown over the years is that it's not something you gravitate towards naturally, but when it's good, you do appreciate it.
Well,
it might not be your favorite thing, but you respect them, I'm just saying. And that makes you not just like this grump. You just don't, it's not your taste, but when a good version of it is put in front of you, you can appreciate it. That's all anyone can really ask, because not everything's going to be to everyone's taste. You're upfront about your taste, you explain your taste well, and, you know, and I like to be critical too, but maybe I'm a slightly more fanboyish in some respects, so maybe the balance is out, I don't know.
Well, there are certain things that still get me excited. Like, when I watch, you know, a 1970s movie where Godzilla twists Mechagodzilla's head off, you know, I'm going to be right there. I'm cheering. Like, then I'm getting excited. You know, if guys in monster suits are wailing on each other, that's the kind of action I want to see.
Everyone has simple pleasures.
Yeah.
It might not always be in the same medium. Some people like simple pleasures. I think everyone has a simple pleasure that they like in terms of like food or music.
Some sort of creature comfort.
Creature comforts is a great way of putting it. And I feel like there's that for film. And not everyone's going to... The fact that a lot of people like the same thing for a while is okay. Mm. But it's also okay to be more into other stuff. And that's fine too.
Okay.
So don't feel bad about it. Don't apologize. And again, if anyone feels alienated, sorry, but we want to have frank conversations about how we feel about movies, and we're not always going to agree on it. And the important thing is that we talk to each other and like are respectful. And I struggle with this as much as everybody. It's easy to be snarky, but I'm trying here. So let's do one more letter and let's close it out.
All right. Here's a letter from Andrew, and this is a kind of a significant letter. It's a good one to end on.
Oh dear.
It says, from Andrew, it says, hello all. Firstly, thanks for the podcast on Star Hike.
Yes.
This is a Star Hike email. I was laughing so hard, it was truly amazing. If you don't know, I'm the poor sap that created it.
Oh my god! Really? That's amazing!
This is Andrew Diamond, the creator of Star Hike, writing in.
Wow! Thank you so much for writing in!
And it says, check out my IMDb! And if you would ever want to chat about it, I would love to, after all this time, 20 years ago, to say the story of Star Hike. They always say it started with good intentions, but ended up as a total clusterfuck. Trust me, what happened making it was far better than the show itself. You've got drama, love and sex, death of actors, lightning strikes, broadcasters collapse, warehouse explosions, making a show by community, death threats from Red Dwarf fans, and so much more. Let's just say that I still have nightmares about it. Honestly, I can laugh about it now. If you ever want to know a cursed project and how not to make sci-fi, then look no further. Anyway, I thought I would reach out as I honestly enjoyed your podcast about it. Kind regards, Andrew Diamond, CEO of Bazooka Bunny Limited, creator of Star Hike. Thank you for writing in. I hope we weren't
too...
I'm glad that you didn't listen to our podcast and hate us at the end of it.
Yeah, which would have been your right. Sometimes, you know, we were critical as well as having fun with it. Indeed, like, I've had people who like make movies and TV contact me about a review I did of their work, and usually they're pretty cool. Usually they're very respectful. Sometimes they want to correct something maybe I got wrong or misinterpreted, and we can have a conversation about that. But every once in a while, it's, you know, they had a different take. And that's fine too. But it's really, really cool of you to reach out. And I just thank you so much, Andrew, for, first off, you know, it's hard to make anything, and it sounds like it was nearly impossible to make Star Hike. So kudos to you for persevering and for making something that was interesting and fun to talk about. And again, it's widely available. You can see it on Tubi now, I think, still for free. And you can listen to our show about it, which apparently is endorsed by the creator of Star Hike. So that's a relief. It's nice to know that we towed a line of like being critical while being respectful enough that you could enjoy it. I'm glad we can do that. That's tough to do.
I'll say this for Star Hike. Okay, Mr. Diamond, you wrote in and you said that it was a clusterfuck. It was difficult to make. That people died and it was a total disaster. That doesn't necessarily read on the show. It looks like you put something together. It was cogent. It had a premise. We were on record for how much we disliked it, but I wouldn't call it like a clusterfuck of a production. It doesn't look like it was falling apart in front of us. It looks like you actually
put something
together.
I wouldn't have assumed it was a disaster. I just assumed it was cheap.
Yeah, like it's clearly you know, very low budget. We're not necessarily a big fan of the writing, but it didn't look like a
good ideas though.
On
like
screen.
Really good ideas and, in that show for the record.
Yeah, some fun ideas and
if
it looked intentional, then you did something right. And so I'll say that for Star Hike.
Hey, listen, and seriously, just thank you for reaching out. Thank you for being cool. Thank you for appreciating what we tried to do with the show. And thank you for making Star Hike. It was an exciting journey to go on. We go on these journeys on Cancel Too Soon to like explore TV shows that didn't manage to find an audience, that were canceled very quickly after one episode or one season, because we think they're fundamentally interesting. And it means a lot to us that we could make a show about your show that you could appreciate. So thank you for that. And that makes me feel really good. Thank you so much. That's really, really nice. So on that note, maybe we should try to reach out. That could be fun. But on that note, thank you everybody for listening to We've Got Mail. If you would like to participate in We've Got Mail, even if you didn't produce one of the shows that we reviewed on our podcast, even if you didn't, you can do so by emailing us. Our email address is letters@criticallyacclaimed.net. We also have a P.O. box, which we will get to next time, because my COVID isolation will end in a couple of days, and we'll be able to do it, and we're sorry about that, and we'll do a whole big, however many letters we get, we'll do them all. Whitney, what is our P.O. box?
Yeah, send it to Critically Acclaimed Network, P.O. box 641565, Los Angeles, California, 90064.
Yeah. And, of course, we're on Twitter, @CriticAcclaim. I'm @WilliamDeBiani.
I'm @WhitneySeibold.
If you would like to listen to any of our other exclusive shows, or even if you would just like to listen to our podcasts without any ads whatsoever, you can do so over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. For even $1 a month, you get to vote for future episodes, you get the ad-free shows, you're going to get our new upcoming show, Step Me Up, Step Me Down, where we're going to review every single movie and episode of the Step Up franchise. We have a podcast called Only the Best, where we review every single film ever nominated for Best Picture. We just released an episode about the Best Picture nominees in 1948. We have All Our Yesterdays, our podcast where we review every single episode of Star Trek in order. We missed one episode last week, which was partially because we were sick and partially because there was an audio issue and we recorded an entire episode and we have to do it all over again.
Yeah.
So we'll come back to that in like the next couple of days. I will give you that episode in toto. Just it's going to be re-recorded. It happens. Not often, thank God, but it happens.
Yeah, we've lost just like a handful of episodes in the past.
We've been doing this for over 10 years. I would say the number of episodes that we were unable to release for technical reasons in the single digits. Mm-hmm. Like, and this is us putting out anywhere from 5 to 10 podcasts a week sometimes. So I feel really good about it. It's always embarrassing when it happens, though, so sorry about that. And, of course, we have commentary tracks, and we have Google Hangouts, or sorry, Discord Hangouts now. There's a ton of stuff over at patreon.com/criticallyacclaimednetwork. If you can subscribe, it really helps keep our show going. And if you can't, totally cool. Leave us a review if you find us anywhere, Apple, Spotify, wherever. Mm. It always helps us jump up the algorithm and find more people. It really means the world to us. Anyway, that's it for the show. Thank you, everybody, for listening. Sincerely yours, Bibbs and Whitney.